Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Monday, June 8th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We turn to the front page for our first story. New normal, new jobs. This is reported by Bennett Goldstein. Many companies are finding themselves in need of specialists who were not in demand a few months ago. Rachel Waters never anticipated she would be the first face people see upon entering the sliding glass doors at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Working as a surgical technician for more than 5 years, she was accustomed to the operating room, where she passes physicians' instruments and holds open bodily tissues during procedures. But with the onset of COVID-19 pandemic and temporary cancellation of elective operations for Iowa hospitals, Waters was reassigned during March and April. Working 13-hour shifts at the hospital front desk, she screened employees and visitors for signs of illness, holding a thermal scanner next to their foreheads and running through a list of health questions. She said, "We're here to serve the community in this unknown and scary time. I'd say we all do it with a smile, but we have masks on, so you can't see." Waters is one of about 25 to 30 trained employees at Mercy One, who staff 4 stations at building entrances. They rotate in shifts, and administrators anticipate they will continue the practice for about 1 year. But it is not just hospital staff who have found new workplace duties during the time or the heat of the pandemic. Area employers have created new job roles as part of a larger effort to keep customers and staff safe. Under the changing circumstances of the pandemic, it is unclear how long the demand for such work will last, but in the absence of a COVID-19 vaccine or treatment, it could continue for months. As states continue to lift operational restrictions on businesses, the need for janitorial workers and sanitation crews has intensified. "A lot of the employers are opening up and they need people," said Lori Klein, regional manager of Express Employment Professionals in Dubuque. "Some are just the true temporary positions, but some are long-term and could be a part of their core team." Grocery stores ramped up hiring efforts as customer demand for goods spiked following the closure of restaurants and schools. Providing safe shopping experience at Hy-Vee on Dodge Street was paramount as safety concerns went viral, so employees now perform extra disinfection among their regular duties, said store manager Steve Duttmeyer. "We've always had sanitizer wipes by the front entrances for people to wipe their own carts," he said. "Then we moved to having someone up there during the peak hours. Now we have them there all the time to wipe down carts for our customers. I don't see that ever ending." Meanwhile, a specialty market has opened for acrylic glass, and Dubuque Glass Company cannot keep it in stock. The business receives requests daily for employees to install barriers or provide supplies for do-it-yourself projects. "We've done both Dubuque casinos. We've done a lot of the hotels in town. We've done doctor's offices, dentist's offices, veterinary clinics," said company CFO Lee Ann Cool. "Just getting the plexiglass now is harder." While shifts in personnel responsibilities have already begun, industry analysts predict that the pandemic ultimately will lead to a long-term growth in automation. Interact Analysis, an intelligent automation research firm, forecasts that the global industrial automation sector will see a 3.6% decline in revenue in 2020 from about $10 billion to $9.6 billion. However, the firm predicts rapid growth in 2021, accelerated by the pandemic as consumers undertake automation projects that were delayed this year. Randy Decker, president and co-owner of Decker Precision Machining in Piasta, Iowa, said he isn't currently planning to purchase any additional automated equipment because of the economic downturn brought on by the pandemic. Hiring at his business is also on hold. "We're still maintaining our workforce," he said. "We don't know if we are going to get slower or if all of a sudden we're going to pick up." The article is accompanied by a picture on the front page of Mercy One employee Lori Ballou, who is a surgical technician. She's using a thermal scanner Friday to check the temperatures of employees as they enter the hospital for their work day. Lori Ballou is, of course, wearing a mask. Also on the front page, the Biz Buzz column by Jeff Montgomery, Telegraph Herald senior reporter. It says the Biz Buzz shares business tidbits from around the tri-states each Monday. This week, we highlight developments in Dubuque and East Dubuque, Illinois. And the headline is Lacoma Unveils New Clubhouse. Crews recently completed a new clubhouse at Lacoma Golf Club in East Dubuque, marking another major milestone as the business recovers from a devastating fire in January 2019. Co-owner Sarah Cunningham said the new clubhouse is roughly the same size as the new one that was destroyed. However, the new space, which is all located on one level, is laid out in a far more efficient way that allows patrons to get around with greater ease. It features a full kitchen, an outdoor patio, pro shop, and a banquet space capable of serving 100 people. From the sneak peeks that customers have had, they have given us some really great feedback, said Cunningham. They're excited to have a new space that was designed in a smart way. In the immediate aftermath of the fire, officials at Lacoma erected a pole barn that served as a temporary clubhouse. Cunningham said officials will continue to use this structure as a facility that can host larger banquets and events. Throughout the current season, the spread of COVID-19 has forced Lacoma to adopt strict limitations. Many of these recently eased, but Cunningham said it still isn't business as usual. Tee times are spaced out further than usual, and golf carts can only be used by one person at a time. Access to the new clubhouse also has been impacted. Customers only can enter the pro shop in small numbers and are required to wear masks. The bar must be accessed via a walk-up window, and the food can be enjoyed on the outdoor patio. She said, "We thought there'd be a big celebration. Instead, we have just quietly moved in." Even so, she is confident people will enjoy the new space even more once they fully experience it. Cunningham said, "This was a rare opportunity to create something brand new, and we knew exactly what we wanted and needed to do with it." Lacoma Golf Club can be reached at 815-747-3874. Another item on the BizFeed column, new coffee house location. Lacoma isn't the only business pushing forward in the aftermath of a fire. Tim Rusk, general manager of Charlotte's Coffee House in Dubuque, confirmed he will open a new coffee shop at the corner of University Avenue and North Grandview Avenue about midsummer. The new shop will be located in Hartig Drug, 1600 University Avenue. It will feature a walk-up, indoor counter, as well as a drive-through option. This will be the second location for Charlotte's Coffee House, which will continue to operate at 1104 White Street. The location was severely damaged by a fire in the summer of 2018, but reopened the following summer. With COVID, I think a lot of people are trying to get back to normal, but we're all realizing it is going to be a new normal, Russ said. A lot more people might find a drive-through and that convenience factor to be more appealing these days. 4 or 5 new employees will be hired to staff the new location. It will be open 7 days per week and feature the full menu of beverages available at the White Street location, with the exception of alcoholic drinks. The food menu will be slightly reduced, but still feature favorites such as paninis, acai, and burritos. Russ said, "We'll have the same level of quality here." An upcoming series of outdoor dining events aims to aid local restaurants struggling amid the pandemic. Dubuque Main Street announced an outdoor dining series that will take place on 5 days later this month. On each occasion, a different portion of the downtown will be closed to traffic, allowing restaurants in that stretch to expand seating into the street. Michaela Freeberger, a program specialist for Dubuque Main Street, thinks the event will be a hit for restaurants and customers alike. She said, "This hasn't been done yet in Dubuque on this scale. but we think that getting these people outside in June will be a great opportunity. Each outdoor dining event will stretch from noon until 7:30 p.m. The first one is slated for Friday, June 19th, while others will be held on Saturday, June 20, Sunday, June 21, Thursday, June 25, and Friday, June 26. The outdoor dining events will take place in various locations throughout the downtown, including portions of Main Street and the Millwork District. Freeburger hopes these events provide a shot in the arm for its struggling local eateries. Many restaurants still are not opening for dine-in customers, and many have a capacity that isn't anywhere close to normal, she said. In a lot of cases, they've gone from having a large staff to only having the owners run the show. Specifics on the location of each outdoor dining event, as well as the restaurants participating, will be updated at downtowndubuque.org by Tuesday, June 9th. And finally, on the front page, a third story, area colleges track respond to bias incidents. And this is reported by Ali Hinga. In 2019, University of Wisconsin-Platteville officials received 83 reports from people who witnessed acts of bias on or off campus. In those reports, students, community members, faculty, and staff detailed instances in which they saw people targeted for their race, gender, national origin, religion, or other identities, said Linda Mulroy Bowden, Executive Director of Student Life and Development at University of Wisconsin-Platteville. A lot of people think that these kinds of situations don't happen in Platteville, and I would say that they absolutely do. Those kinds of impacts aren't limited to the UWP campus. Officials from other local colleges say they track and receive reports of incidents in which members of the campus community experience acts of bias, hate, or discrimination. College officials say they have processes in place to address those incidents when they arise, and that they seek to create campus environments that are inclusive of all students. Still, they say that work remains to be done. Said Molly Burroughs Schumacher, Assistant Dean of Students at Lawrence College, I know that, like everywhere, there are places that we likely fall short, so we continue to work to do the best that we can. For most local colleges, officials provided some data on how often they receive reports of acts of bias or discrimination. UWP, the largest college in the tri-state area, had the highest report count. Other smaller local colleges generally reported 10 incidents or fewer over 1 or 2 year periods, said Krista Weber, Chief Human Resources Officer at Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore. It definitely happens. You always work to increase awareness about your tracking and complaint process so that people feel comfortable. But then, if you get too low in your numbers, you worry that your awareness isn't good enough. Kelly McMahon, Executive Director for Risk Management at Northeast Iowa Community College, said incidents can take a variety of forms, such as experiencing hate speech at a job placement or feeling targeted because of gender identity. Some reports don't involve intentional discrimination, but rather students who feel unheard when instructors don't understand the barriers they face to learning. McMahon said it's a wide variety of things, but we do track, we do investigate, and we're working towards a resolution. Amy Edmonds, the coordinator of university safety awareness training and preparation at University of Dubuque, said members of the school community seem to feel comfortable reporting when incidents happen. She said the number of reports received does not seem unusual compared to other similarly sized schools. Edmonds said, once we get notice of things, we're responding. Still, officials said there likely are additional incidents of which they are not aware. Said Kate Zanger, Vice President for Student Life at Clark University, if you are in a group with a marginalized identity, you're going to experience situations that you consider bias, and I think that not everyone feels comfortable in sharing those experiences with others. They really have to trust and feel safe and respected in order to share that. College officials said that when they receive reports of bias or hate, they have a process in place to handle them. Edmonds said, "Every time someone puts in a report or we get notice of an event, we're reaching out and making contact with people that are involved." At Clark, Zanger typically appoints two people to investigate reported incidents, and they meet with the person who made the report and follow up with others who might be involved. Then action can be taken if appropriate. Clark officials seek to stop any problem behaviors immediately, but also to help people who perpetrated bias incidents learn about what is appropriate. Zanger said, "If you take the approach of, we want to help educate you about appropriate behavior, and we want to stop this behavior, I think most people will learn from it, making it a teachable moment for people." Ultimately, school officials said they seek, through their processes, to create campus environments in which students feel welcome. "If we don't have an environment that's welcoming and inclusive, and where people feel like different values, different identities, different experiences are valued, then we are not doing our students any favors, and we are not supporting our students who are here for an education and are members of underrepresented populations," Mulroy Brown said. The article is accompanied by pictures of Linda Mulroy Bowden and Molly Burroughs Schumacher, who were mentioned as commenting in the article. On the Dubuque and Tri-State page, John Cruz reports clouds in forecast for Joe Davis County tourism. This is from Galena. Joe Davis County tourism officials are cutting about $500,000 from their upcoming budget in anticipation of a significant decline in visitors. Galena Country Tourism leaders opted to reduce their budget for fiscal year 2021, which begins in July, in response to an anticipated 40% drop in tourism revenue coming into the county. Rose Noble, president of and CEO of Galena Country Tourism, said the COVID-19 pandemic is expected to significantly hamper local tourism. Noble said, "International travel is going to be next to nothing. That does severely impact us, so it's something we will have to prepare for." Last fiscal year, Galena County Country Tourism spent about $1 million in marketing to Joe Davis County. The organization had originally intended to spend about $1.2 million next fiscal year, but the budget was decreased to $733,000 after officials saw the impact of the pandemic. Noble said the release of a vaccine to the public could greatly change the organization's current tourism outlook, but at the moment, it is unlikely tourists will come to Joe Davis County in the same numbers as in previous years. She added that many businesses are likely to adapt to the new conditions, but multiple businesses also could close. She said, "The pandemic has forced a lot of them to rethink their business model." To compensate for lost revenue, Galena Country Tourism will reduce its larger marketing efforts and focus primarily on online advertising, Noble said. Though Galena Country Tourism expects significant decreases in revenue compared to previous years, the organization's governing board approved a $4,000 raise and $5,000 bonus for Noble, bringing her salary up to $91,650. Mary Sevi, chair of the organization's personnel committee, said the raise was given based on Noble's performance in fiscal year 2020, which included key strides for the group. Sevi said, "Everyone is extremely happy with her and the job that she has done. We don't want to lose her." Noble said she was grateful for the raise and bonus. She noted that her salary is comparable with other county tourism leaders in the state and that she still earns less than her predecessor, Chris Hamilton. And now it's time for a look at the opinion page. We have two views on their title, Other Views, The Burden of Race and Rage. This is by Star Parker for the Telegraph Herald. "In 1992, I operated a small publishing business in Los Angeles. It was destroyed as a result of riots that ensued after four police officers were acquitted of charges of excessive violence in the beating of Rodney King. It changed my life. I focused my resolve to work in public policy to change destructive realities that were taking our distressed communities and the whole nation in what I saw was the wrong direction. That was almost 30 years ago, yet it's still going on. Chaos and destruction, supposedly justified by racial injustice. Why? For the past week, I sat bunkered at night in my Washington, D.C. apartment as the nation's capital was being transformed into a war zone. Domestic terrorists roam the streets, destroying private property, wanting to destroy our nation, pretending to be rioting to save it. They deface the Lincoln Memorial and the World War II Memorial and torch St. John's Episcopal Church, where presidents have prayed since 1816. President Donald Trump touched the heart of the issue in remarks he made in the White House Rose Garden, saying, "America is founded on the rule of law. It is the foundation of our prosperity, our freedom, and our very way of life." He then courageously ventured off the White House grounds, crossed Lafayette Square, and stood in front of St. John's Church, holding up a Bible and declaring the greatness of our nation and his resolve to keep it safe. I do not believe any president has presented himself outside in public in this fashion since President Ronald Reagan was shot in 1981. Yet the left-wing media mocked Trump. No sane American of any political persuasion is not appalled by the horrible death of George Floyd at the hands of policemen. But the answer to flouting of the law by anyone demands that we recommit ourselves to universal respect and execution of the law, not throw it in the trash. In an announcement from my organization, Urban Cure, that called for a national pastoral prayer for America, I note, quote, "George Floyd did not die as a black man, but as a human being, under the protection of American laws, and the mortal assault on him inflicted a deep wound on every American, not just American blacks. People who think it their duty now to express sympathy to black folk must learn how to recognize that the grief is their own and not that of some other looking for their generosity," unquote. Regarding allegations of racism, I say, I don't agree that our nation is racist. That mantra is the poison that entrenches resentment and division among us. The daily hunt for racism from top to bottom of our nation's institutions has institutionalized the perception of racism in the post-civil rights era. They have systematically reduced the fundamentals of citizenship to race in the guise of diversity and inclusion, and these elusive lies have shown increasing distrust and painful social distance in discord, in conflict with our reality. I say, most Americans are cordial to their neighbors, work hand in hand across racial lines, and just want to be left alone. Why this chaos 30 years after Los Angeles was torn up and my business destroyed? I say it is because respect for the law and every human being comes only with humility, and that humility comes only when we see that law rooted in God and every person created in His image. But too much of our nation's reality has been controlled by arrogance, not humility. Arrogance that we don't need the God of our fathers and founders. Those on the left have convinced too many that our answers lie in politics, their secular humanism, and moral relativism. The result is the destruction of life and property that true law, adhered to by true believers, protects. Only return to eternal truths will save us. That was the view presented by Star Parker, and it gives a little description of what she's the president of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And a parallel column, other view, excess of arms exacerbating police brutality in America. This was written by Cynthia Tucker. With a deranged narcissist in the Oval Office and his lackey controlling the Department of Justice, there is no point in looking to the federal government to curb police violence. Instead, President Donald J. Trump will do everything in his power to encourage it. In the wake of protests over the murder of George Floyd, he has demanded that governors crack down on promoters. You have to dominate. If you don't dominate, You're wasting your time, he told them. Moreover, most local police authorities are under local control. Mayors, city councils, district attorneys, police chiefs, sheriffs. That's where the accountability for police misconduct begins. But Congress could take a significant step toward reining in that misconduct by passing a bill to end the practice of allowing the Pentagon to give surplus war equipment to local police departments. There is simply no good reason for police in any city, from Washington to Wichita, to roll down the streets in armored personnel carriers armed with battering rams and grenade launchers. They are not going to war. American citizens are not enemy combatants. Several Democrats already have announced their intention to introduce legislation to end the practice. Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, has said he would introduce such a measure as an amendment to the all-important annual defense policy bill, which would give a decent shot at passing because Republicans are deeply invested in the defense bill. After protests broke out in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 following the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by a police officer, local law enforcement authorities took to the streets in armored characters, further inflaming tensions. They show little inclination toward restraint or de-escalation. The same thing is occurring in cities around the country right now. Offloading surplus military hardware to local police departments was never a good idea. The practice started back during the 1990s as violent crime peaked and local and federal authorities were feverishly devoted to winning the so-called war on drugs. After the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the program ramped up, doling out battlefield gear even to small towns no self-respecting terrorist ever heard of. Law enforcement agents become enamored of images of themselves decked out like soldiers on special ops missions. According to the New York Times, the website of a South Carolina sheriff's department featured its SWAT team, quote, dressed in black with guns drawn, flanking an armored vehicle that looks like a tank and has a mounted 50 caliber gun, unquote. Poor neighborhoods are subjected to the military-style hardware much more often than affluent ones, and the consequence of that sort of policing is often less safety, not more. When the police behave like an occupying force, the residents return the favor, treating them with suspicion and contempt. That hardly makes it more likely that police will get the information they need to solve crimes. The administration of President Barack Obama understood that and curbed the Pentagon program after Ferguson. During the final years of the Obama administration, the Pentagon reported that local law enforcement agencies had returned 126 tracked armored vehicles, 138 grenade launchers, and 1,623 bayonets, the Times said. Pause for a moment just to consider that. Why would any police department, even New York City's army of 36,000 officers, need bayonets and grenade launchers? Once you implant in the heads of police officers the notion that they need battlefield gear, their use of violence against unarmed citizens escalates as a natural consequence. But guess what happened when Trump took office? He removed Obama's restraints on the Pentagon program, once again allowing local law enforcement agents to go to battle against the citizens they are sworn to protect. No surprise there. In 2017, Trump gave a speech in which he urged police officers not to worry about injuring a suspect during arrest. Police violence against black people is a problem as old as the nation itself. It didn't start with Trump's presidency and won't end when it's over. Rather, the racist culture that is embedded among so many law enforcement agencies showed itself clearly when major police unions enthusiastically backed Trump's election. When Trump is finally gone, the campaign to eradicate that culture can begin in earnest. That was submitted by Cynthia Tucker, who won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 2007. She is a former editorial page editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She also was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2004 and 2006. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Monday, June 8th, and this is on Iris the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Herman M. Motsch, M-O-T-S-C-H, 94, of Dubuque, passed away peacefully at home on Friday, June 5, surrounded by his family. A private family funeral service will be held on today, June 8, at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road, Dubuque. Herman was born on October 20, 1925, the son of Martin and Frances Kircher Motsch. When his mother died at an early age of 39, Herman stepped up as the oldest to help run the family farm. He retired from the Dubuque Packing Company after 30 years of employment. Herman had a great love of the outdoors and spent many days at Leisure Lake. He was a jack of all trades and loved to tinker with anything he thought he could repair. You might have seen him at the Diamond Joe or even on the dance floor when he was younger. To know him, you loved him. He was such a kind and giving man. He is survived by his daughter, Donna, and her spouse, Mel Christensen, stepdaughters, Linda, and spouse, Don Slattery, and Barb McDermott, all of Dubuque, and stepson, Danny Ring, of Bernard, Iowa, brothers, Ernie Motsch, of Bernard, and Jean and spouse Ruthie of Motsch of Dubuque. He is also survived by many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandchild. Herman was preceded in death by his parents, his first wife Rose Wiedenbacher Motsch, his second wife Virginia Ring Motsch, a daughter Carol Upman, son-in-law Richard Upman, stepsons Randy and Wayne Ring, stepdaughter Susan Dorr, grandson Michael Upman, and step-grandsons Jim Slattery and Mike McDermott Jr., and his sister Mary Nita Hansen. Secondly, we have Calvin R. Burns, Calvin known as Cal R. Burns, 80, of Dubuque, died June 5th. Visitation 3 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 9, at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, June 10, at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Current health guidelines require half capacity in the funeral home. Entombment will be in Linwood Cemetery. And we have a list of funeral services with the information. First, Richard E. Henricks, service at 10 a.m. today, Holy Spirit Parish, Holy Trinity Church, 1701 Romberg Avenue. Craig W. Kohler, services 10:30 a.m. Thursday, June 11, the Grandview United Methodist Church, visitation 9 to 10:15 a.m. Thursday at the church. Jerome L. Lammers, Dyersville, services 11 a.m. Wednesday, June 10th, the Kramer Funeral Home on 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, visitation 9 a.m. Wednesday until the time of services at the funeral home. From Galena, Suzanne C. Lightheart, committal service 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 9th, the Greenwood Cemetery, Galena, visitation after 10 a.m. Tuesday at the cemetery. From Dubuque, Deborah S. Newcomer, services 3 p.m. Tuesday, June 9, the Bear Funeral Home on Main Street. Visitation noon Tuesday until time of service at the funeral home. From Dubuque, Emmingard M. Sadler of East Dubuque, services will be 10:30 today. Service, Church of the Nativity on Alta Vista Street in Dubuque. The visitation is 9 a.m. until time of services at the church. And list we have Dennis R. Whalen of Vinton. Graveside services 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 11, St. Mary's Lycurgus Cemetery, Waukon. And finally, from Platteville, Lana M. Withrow. Visitation 3 to 8 p.m. today, the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville. And now we turn to the sports page for an auto racing story from the Dubuque Speedway. This is reported by Brendan West. Fairgrounds, much more fun with spectators. For the first time all race season, the Dubuque Fairground Speedway had butts in the seats, but around the neighborhood of 600 fans on hand. After six exciting features on Sunday night, track organizers are hoping their weekly programs will keep them there. Dubuque's Joel Callahan took checkered in the International Motor Contest Association's 25-lap GSI late model feature, earning the night's top prize of $650 on the second week of racing at the Speedway. It's fun. It's always fun when you can win in front of your family and friends locally at your home track, said Callahan, who started in the fourth slot in his number 40 car and trailed pole sitter Terry Neal for most of the race. It was a good night. We've been tweaking into the year. Seems like we kind of tweaked it the right way tonight, but it's really nice to see all of these fans here tonight. I knew that they'd have a good crowds. There's nothing else going on, so it's really going to help racing build at that fan base back up, which is what we really need. Another big winner was Cascade Iowa's Brandon White in the 15-lap hobby stock feature, putting two Dubuque County locals among the six winners in victory lane at the Speedway. White's race was quite a commotion, with cautions on each of the first three laps and quite a bit of maneuvering behind Loudon, Iowa's Christian Lord Jordan. After starting off in the seventh slot, White worked his way up to second place by lap 9. Three laps later, White overtook Jordan's number 87 car and was able to hold off both Jordan and Dakota Simonson through the rest of the race. The hobby stock feature ended under caution, with White staving off Simonson's number 60 car for the win, to the applause of Sunday's crowd for the first time all season in Dubuque. Said White, just 20 years old, "It's crazy, the race was all over, but it was fun. It's a lot better with fans." Joe LaFrenz opened up Sunday's feature wins by clinching the eight car 10-lap four-cylinder series, outlasting Dubuque's John W. Campbell. After White's win came Wayne Hora, Anamosa, Iowa, in the two-man cruiser feature, and Gage Neal from Ely, Iowa, in the 15-lap IMCA Sport Mod. There were a few costly wrecks in the IMCA modified feature, namely bumping pole sitter Timmy Current from Bernard, Iowa, out of the race by lap 11. By that time, Freeport, Illinois' Jeff Larson had secured the top spot and was able to fend off Dubuque's Tyler Madigan over the final 9 laps. Track promoter Kevin Kotz, who also serves as general manager at the fairgrounds, called Sunday night a success, adding, "Drivers much prefer a live audience over the spectatorless season opener the Speedway ran." Said Kotz, "It was fantastic. It's good for the fairgrounds, but it's good for the community too. They like to race, but there's nothing better than your fans being up there." The article is accompanied by a picture of four of the race cars jockeying for position in the weekly series at the Fairgrounds Speedway. From Green Bay, University of Wisconsin Green Bay hires Will Ryan. Green Bay is turning its basketball program over to Will Ryan, the son of former Wisconsin coach Bo Ryan. Athletic Director Charles Guthrie announced Sunday that the school and Ryan have agreed to a deal in principle, though final contract details are still being worked out. The 41-year-old Ryan comes to Green Bay after posting a 14-13 record in his lone season as the head coach at Division II program Wheeling in West Virginia. He previously worked as an assistant in Ohio in 2014 to 2019 and North Dakota State 2007 to 2014. He worked on his father's Wisconsin staff from 2002 to 2007, where he served as a director of basketball operations and video coordinator. Bo Ryan was Wisconsin's coach from 2001 to 2015 after previously coaching at Wisconsin, Platteville, and Milwaukee. Will Ryan replaces Link Darner, who went 92-80 and posted a winning record in all but one of his five seasons at Green Bay. And we have a U.S. Hockey League story, reported by Jim Leitner, Jansen returning to USHL. Evan Jansen feels indebted to the United States Hockey League for the opportunities it helped create for him, and he'd like to pay it forward to the next generation of young players. Jansen, who played an integral role for the Dubuque Fighting Saints in winning the Anderson Cup and Clark Cup in 2012-2013, will return to the league this fall as an assistant coach with the Cedar Rapids Rough Riders. Following his lone season in Dubuque, Jansen won the NCAA Division I championship at the University of Denver and briefly played professionally. Jansen, who is 27, said, "Coming to the USHL, that was the first time in my career where I really faced some adversity. A lot of guys come into junior hockey after being big-time scorers in lower levels of hockey, and that success doesn't always carry over. Sometimes you have to learn how to play a different role." He goes on to say, "Dubuque is where I learned how to be a 200-foot player, and it helped me realize the defensive side of my game was lacking. That year turned me into more of a complete player and someone who could be relied upon, and that's ultimately why I was able to have some success at the University of Denver." The Green Bay, Wisconsin native tallied 10 goals, 23 points, and 32 penalty minutes in 51 regular season games with Dubuque, and added 4 goals and 6 points in 11 playoff games. At Denver, he contributed 14 goals, 47 points, and 56 penalty minutes in 146 games under his former Dubuque coach, Jim Montgomery. Jansen split the 2017-2018 season between the Iowa Wild of the American Hockey League and the Rapid City Rush of the ECHL. He spent the following season in England, tallying 11 goals and 20 points in 51 games for the Guilford Flames. On and off the ice, Evans has played integral role to the success of teams through his passion for hockey. Rough Riders head coach Mark Carlson said, "He will make a significant impact on our Rough Riders players and staff, as well as in our community. We all look forward to working with him." Jansen spent this past winter working in commercial real estate in Dallas. He also helped out with the Dallas Junior Stars youth program after being recommended by Montgomery. Jansen said, "I quickly realized you have to enjoy what you do every day. Commercial real estate wasn't for me. I'm not the kind of person who can stare at a computer for 9 hours a day, but that experience helped me realize my true passion is still hockey. I had always toyed with the idea of getting into coaching. It took a year out of hockey to realize that's where I wanted to be. I'm really excited for the opportunity in CR, and I'm looking forward to it." And he looks forward to working with one of the deans of the USHL coaching fraternity. Carlson joined the Rough Riders to begin their inaugural season in 1999-2000, won a Clark Cup championship in 2005, and has been named USHL Coach of the Year 3 times. Jansen said his success, not only on the ice, but also in developing people, was a big reason why it seemed like such a good fit for me. In all my conversations with him, it was obvious why they've had so much success over the last 20 years with him at the helm. I'm extremely excited about the opportunity to be able to go back to the league where things really started to flourish for me as a player. To be able to go back to that league and hopefully have the impact on players from a coaching standpoint is really exciting for me." And the article is accompanied by a picture of Evan Jansen. On the current page, we have a story, "It's Time for Music. Northeast Iowa School of Music reopens today for lessons virtually and in person." This is reported by Megan Gloss of the Telegraph Herald. "Music is ready to echo once again throughout the halls at Dubuque's Northeast Iowa School of Music. After closing its doors nearly 3 months ago amid the COVID-19 pandemic, and instead of offering music lessons virtually, the organization will reopen today for one-on-one instruction in piano, voice, guitar, strings, woodwinds, brass, and percussion," said Executive Director David Resnick. "We've been speaking with the parents of students and have been making preparations. During the summer, there usually are fewer lessons, but we've had a lot to think about to get ready for this. Mindful of the risks posed by COVID-19, the school has put several protocols into practice for students and teachers returning to lessons in person based on recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That includes including NISOM's office and answering questions about how they have been feeling and any symptoms they may be experiencing. It includes custom-made acrylic shields that have been strategically placed throughout each of the school's private studios to divide teacher and student, as well as additional keyboard instruments. There is access to hand sanitation and the regular disinfecting of instruments. We've even put up a mirror in our L-shaped hallway so that people will be able to see if a person is coming from another direction, and so they can continue to keep their distance, Resnick said. Similar to other avenues of one-on-one instruction, private music lessons were early to suffer a blow amid the pandemic. However, in an interview with the Telegraph Herald in April, Resnick said the school aimed to be as quick in its response. He said, "We jumped on it and tried to offer an alternative right away. We followed the Dubuque Community Schools lead, canceling face-to-face instruction and offering online lessons. We sent an email out to families on March 16 with three options. To encourage social distancing, students could take advantage of those online options. Parents could donate the lesson free to reduce the financial impact on their teacher, or parents could request a refund for missed or discontinued lessons." Resnick said that Northern Iowa School of Music, Northeast Iowa School of Music, is down one-third in revenue compared with this part of last year's trimester. The school also made a pledge to continue compensating any of its instructors willing to teach their lessons virtually, even if their students opted not to take advantage of that offering. Resnick said, "We believe that was very important to do." Northeast Iowa School of Music was qualified for the Paycheck Protection Program for its staff as part of the CARES Act. In addition to lessons in person, the school will continue to offer virtual instruction to any student who would prefer it. Resnick said 73% of its 22 instructors will teach face-to-face and virtually, while 27% will teach through Zoom. For students, 76% have indicated that they plan to return for face-to-face lessons, while 24% will receive virtual instruction. "I was surprised," Resnick admitted. "I think connection is something that resonates right now, and in-person music instruction is such an important step in the process of musical development. So people are really counting on the school and me to do the right thing in our preparations to bring students and teachers back in." NISOM recently invested $2,000 to upgrade its Wi-Fi systems to be more conducive to continued virtual music instruction, something Resnick said he believes could become a permanent offering even after the pandemic subsides. He said, "We are called the Northeast Iowa School of Music, and for some of our students living a little further away, we have found that some have preferred Zoom. Especially during the winter time, it could be a good option to have. And I think our ability to be able to offer both lessons in person and virtually will only be something better for the school." NISOM also recently secured a $4,500 emergency grant from the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, which will aid the organization in getting over the hump, Resnick said. "We've had to learn a lot," he said, "and we'll keep learning as we go forward." The article is accompanied by a picture of Anna Spahn singing under the tutelage of Jill Heitzman at the Northeast Iowa School of Music, and an acrylic shield keeps both safe while creating music. And there's also a picture of a sheet of plexiglass installed to separate students and instructors in a rehearsal room. And on the same current page, we have an article, "The Four Steps We Must Practice to Reopen Safely." This is written by Bobby Konaru for the Telegraph Herald. A common experience from the COVID-19 pandemic in America might not be one of fear and anxiety, but a profound sense of confusion. Information about severity, spread, and an ever-expanding list of symptoms has permeated slowly and inconsistently out of hospitals and health departments. Conditions are improving in some states, but outbreaks continue to grow in states like Iowa, where we have seen cases spike in nursing homes and meatpacking plants. To make matters more confusing, every state tests at a different rate, makes those tests available to different populations, and counts their results differently in official statistics. As states have begun partially to lift stay-at-home orders and allow businesses to reopen, it is unclear what benchmarks and metrics are being used to guide policy decisions. We have moved away from mitigation strategies and containment and have now adopted the strategy of living with COVID-19 as safely as possible. These issues only confirm that the health and safety of those we love is ultimately our responsibility. So, how do we reopen safely? We must look toward those who have done it successfully. The good news is that we've been on a learning curve. In the face of enormous risks, American hospitals and clinics have learned how to avoid becoming sites of spread. As we lighten up on the lockdown and bring people back to work, there are wider lessons to be learned from places that never locked down in the first place. We can learn from the group of workers who never stopped working through the epidemic, healthcare workers. What we have learned from this sector is that there are four pillars of action that must be done to live with COVID-19 safely. Number one is hygiene. Wash your hands as frequently as possible. The science is clear that good hygiene reduces viral spread. Number two is social distancing. Keep a goal of 6 feet apart. The chances of respiratory droplets reaching you at that distance is very low. Number three is screening. If you have a business, then screening people for even very mild symptoms is critical so they stay home rather than go into work. And fourth are masks. The main value for masks is that we can spread the disease before we have developed symptoms. And the best way to keep from infecting other people is a mask, because it is our respiratory droplets, when we talk, when we breathe, when we cough, that we have the ability to spread the disease. The concept of masks has stirred controversy and resistance. The Centers for Disease Control is partly to blame, as it initially stated in February that masks weren't needed for the general public. This was a mistake. The evidence is now clear. Masks can reduce viral transmission by up to 50%, and the reduction is even higher when social distancing is combined. During the 1918 Spanish flu, America led the world in wearing masks. It's time that we adopt masks again in this country until we get a vaccine. The author, Bobby Conaru, is board certified in radiation oncology. He did his training at Northwestern University in Chicago and is an adjunct assistant professor at Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. He sees patients at the Wendt Regional Cancer Center, the Helen G. Nassif Radiation Center, and the Leon C. Ferguson Cancer Center. And that does it for today's reading of the Telegraph Herald for this Monday, June 8th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
This is Jim Ralston with an Iris Irish. Short take from the Book of Iowa Curiosities. Check out them checkers. From Dubuque. Don Dwebar, creator and curator of the World's of Checkers Museum, which also doubles as his apartment, is the special breed of collector who turns an obsession into a way of life. I've gone without many meals just so I could buy books on checkers, he told me. I'm what you call a bibliomaniac. I have over 2,000 checker books before I donated them to the Loras, a private college in Dubuque, and the Cleveland Public Library. While books on checkers are his first passion, or more accurately, his first monomania, he recognizes that they're not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. They're not the kind of book you read for fun, like Little Red Riding Hood. They're about checkers strategy, just descriptions, really, of what we call lines of play, from famous matches with an estimated 500 billion possible situations that could rise in a match. I'm not joking there. There's seemingly no end to checker strategy, nor the books that one could write about it. That's just fine with Duber, otherwise known as Mr. Checkers. Lee's Guide to the Game of Checkers was first published in 1897, and I had over 500 copies of that book, representing 127 different editions. Not many collectors would do that. Indeed, it's widely believed that his collection of books on checkers was possibly the largest and most certainly the most complete in the entire world. But Mr. Checker's passion for checkers didn't stop with books. Over the last 30 years, he's filled his tidy apartment with every checker set imaginable, made of everything from wood to bakelite to bone, as well as an impressive variety of checkers memorabilia. A kitchen cabinet, drawers, and even his refrigerator and stove have at one time or another been called into service as the World of Checkers Museum storage and display space. Not to worry, you little fire marshals in training. Don said he unplugged the stove and refrigerator first. And the best part is, his home and museum are open to the public for all to enjoy. It's like the Mona Lisa, Mr. Checker said, of his museum. You really have to see it to appreciate it. The Mona Lisa should be so lucky as to have a passionate and single-minded caretaker and roommate as Don Dwebar. If you feel like visiting Don and his World of Checkers, call 563-556-1944 or email him at checkers21@hotmail.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.